seen of him for so long that the cloud in her mind had gone. She crouched there and listened to the gale and to the movements of the visitor. She didn't move an inch for fear of making a noise. It was as if her stomach and her lungs were slowly becoming frozen. She waited. Perhaps if there was no sound, he would go away. Perhaps he would not come up, to find her here alone. Perhaps very soon Jim would really be back. Or perhaps he was still down there by the rocks, watching the efforts made to save men he had never seen before. While at home his wife lay like a stone in bed, and a half-starved, lustful madman lumbered about the room below. And the child began to cry. The fumbling below stopped. Ginny tried to get out of bed, but she had lost every bone in her body. She couldn't move, and she couldn't swallow. The child stopped, began again more confidently, a thin wail competing against the buffeting of the wind. She was out of bed at last, had picked him up, almost dropping him from her fumbling, hasty hands. The light below quivered and winked. There was a creak on the ladder. She no longer had words to pray, nor resources to turn and hide. She stood at the side of the bed, her back against the wall, the child stirring feebly in her tightened arms, while the trap door slowly lifted. She knew then, as soon as she saw the hand grasping the knotted wood of the floor, that her instinct had not been mistaken, that now she had to face something she had never known before. By the light of the candle he carried, it was possible to see the changes that months of living in lonely caves had brought. The flesh had shrunk from his face and arms. He was in rags and barefoot, his beard and hair straggling and wet, as if he had come from some underwater cave. Yet it was the same Reuben Clemo she had always known, with the pale, self-centered eyes, and the uncertain mouth, and the white creases in the sun-reddened face. She fought down a wave of illness and stared at him.
"Where's my fry pan?" he said. "Stole my fry pan."
The child in her arms wriggled and gasped for breath and began to cry again. Reuben climbed up the steps, and the trap door slammed back into place. For the first time, he saw the bundle that she clutched. Recognition of her was slow in dawning. When it came, all the rest came with it. Remembrance of the injury done him, of why he was forced to shun people and frequent his cottage only at night, of the 10-month-old wound still festering in his side, of his lust for her, of his hatred for the man that had got her this squealing infant, Ross Poldark.
"Lily," he muttered. "White Lily. Sen."
He had been so long apart from people that he had lost the faculty of making them understand. Speech was for him alone. He straightened himself awkwardly, for the muscles had contracted about the wound. Ginny was praying again. He took a step forward.
"Pure Lily," he said.
And then something in the girl's attitude sent his brain clicking over upon an old, forgotten rhythm of his childhood.
"Why standest thou so far off, and hidest thy face in the needful time of trouble? The ungodly for his own lust doth persecute. Let him be taken in the crafty willingness that they have imagined. For the ungodly hath made a boast of his heart's desire, and speaketh good of the covetous."
He took out his knife, an old trapper's knife, with the blade worn down to about 4 inches from years of sharpening and use. In the months of isolation, desire for her had become confused with revenge. In lust, there is always conquest and destruction. The candle began to tremble, and he put it on the floor, where the draught blew the light in gusts about the room and sweated tallow on the boards.
"He sitteth lurking in the thievish corners of the streets, and privily in his lurking dens doth he murder the innocent."
Ginny lost her head and began to scream. Her voice went up and up. As he took another step forward, she forced her legs to move. She was halfway across the bed when Reuben caught her and stabbed at the child. She partly parried the blow, but the knife came away red. The girl's scream changed its tone, became more animal in sound. Reuben stared at the knife with passionate interest, then recovered himself as she reached the trap door. She turned as he came rushing up. He stabbed at her this time, and felt the knife go into her. Then inside him, all that had been tense and hard and burning suddenly ran away through his veins. He dropped the knife and watched her fall. An extra gust of wind blew the candle out. He shouted and groped for the trap door. His foot slipped on something greasy and his hand touched a woman's hair. He recoiled and screamed, banged on the boarding of the room. But he was shut in here forever with the horror he had created. He pulled himself upwards by the bed, blundered across the room, and found the shutters of the window. He fought, shouting with these, but could not find the bolt. Then he thrust forward his whole weight, and the fastenings gave way before him. With a sense of breaking from a prison, he fell forward out of the window, out of the prison, out of life, upon the cobbles below. Book 2, April to May, 1787. Chapter 1. Round the dining table of the parlour of Nampara House, one windy afternoon in 1787, six gentlemen were seated. They had dined and wined well, off part of a large cod, a chine of mutton, a chicken pie, some pigeons, and a fillet of veal with roasted sweetbreads, apricot tart, a dish of cream and almonds and raisins. Mr. Horace Treneglis of Mingus, Mr. Renfrew of St. Anne's, Dr. Choke from Saul, Captain Henshaw from Grambler, Mr. Nathaniel Pierce, the notary from Truro, and their host, Captain Poldark. They had met to approve the preliminary work which had been undertaken at Wheel Leisure, and to decide whether good gold should be risked by them all, with the aim of raising copper. It was an important occasion, which had lured Mr. Treneglis from his Greek, Dr. Choke from the hunting field, and Mr. Pierce from his gouty fireside.
"Well," said Mr. Treneglis, who from his position and seniority occupied the head of the table.
"Well, I'm not going to go against expert advice. We've been humming and hawing for more than 2 years. And if Captain Henshaw says we should begin, well, damn, it's his money being risked as well as mine. And he's the one as did ought to know."
There was a murmur of assent and some qualifying grunts. Mr. Treneglis put a hand behind his ear to gather up the crumbs of comment. Dr. Choke coughed.
"Naturally, we all defer to Captain Henshaw in his experience of working mines. But the success of this venture does not depend on the working of the lode. Otherwise we should have begun a 12 months since. It is conditions in the trade which must determine our course. Now only last week we had occasion to attend upon a patient in Redruth, who was suffering with an imposthume. In fact, he was not our patient, but Dr. Price called us in for further advice. The poor fellow was far gone when I arrived at his considerable house, which had a fine drive and a marble staircase and other evidences of good taste and the means to gratify it. But between us, we were able to alleviate the condition. This gentleman was a shareholder in Dolly Coath Mine, and he let fall the information that it had been decided to close all the lower levels.
There was silence. Mr. Pierce, purple and smiling, said,
"Well, now, in fact, I heard much the same thing. I heard it only last week."
He stopped a moment to scratch under his wig, and Dr. Choke said,
"If the largest copper mine in the world is reducing its work, what chance has our small venture?"
"That doesn't follow if our overheads are smaller," said Ross, who was at the other end of the table, his bony, distinguished face a shade flushed with what he had eaten and drunk. By growing longer side pieces, he had partly hidden his scar, but one end of it still showed as a paler brown line across his cheek.
"The price of copper may fall still lower," said Dr. Choke. "What's that you say? What's that?" asked Mr. Treneglas. "I couldn't hear him," he explained to himself. "I wish he'd speak up."
Choke spoke up.
"Or it may equally well rise," was the reply.
"I look at it this way, gentlemen," said Ross. He drew at his long pipe. "The moment is, on the face of it, a bad one for the starting of ventures large or small. But there are points in our favour which must be borne in mind. Supply and demand rule the prices of ore. Now two large mines have closed this year, and any number of small ones. Dol Coath may soon follow Wheal Reef and Wheal Fortune. This will half the output of the Cornish industry, so supply to the markets will be less, and the price of copper should rise."
"Hear, hear,"
said Captain Henshaw.
"I agree with Captain Poldark," said Mr. Renfrew,
speaking for the first time. Mr. Renfrew was a mine chandler from St. Anne's, and therefore had a double interest in this venture. But so far he had been overawed by the presence of so many gentlemen at the meeting. The blue-eyed Henshaw had no such diffidence.
"Our costs wouldn't be one half what Wheal Reef's was, ton for ton."
"What I should like to know," said Mr. Pierce deprecatingly, "speaking, of course, for the parties I represent, Mrs. Jacqueline Tremwith and Mr. Orchid, as well as for myself, is what figure we should have to obtain for our crude ore in order to show a profit at all. What do you say to that?"
Captain Henshaw picked his teeth.
"It is so much a lottery what the blocks do fetch. We all know that the copper companies are out to get the stuff dirt cheap."
Ross said, "If we get £9 a ton, we shall come to no harm."
"Well," said Mr. Treneglas, "let's see your plan on paper. Where's the map of the old workings? We can follow better then."
Henshaw rose and brought over a big roll of parchment, but Ross stopped him. "We'll have the table clear for this." He rang a handbell, and Prudy came in, followed by Demelza. This was Demelza's first appearance, and she was the object of a number of curious glances. Everyone except Mr. Treneglas, who lived in his own private world, knew something of her history and of the rumours which surrounded her presence here. The talk was old talk now, but scandal died hard when its cause was not removed. They saw a girl of just 17, tall, with dark, untidy hair, and big dark eyes which had a disconcerting glint in them when they happened to meet your own. The glint suggested unusual vitality and a latent mettlesomeness. Otherwise, there was nothing special to remark. Mr. Renfrew peered at her with puckered, astigmatic eyes, and Mr. Pierce, while keeping his gouty feet ostentatiously out of danger, ventured to raise his quizzing glass when he thought Ross was not looking. Then Mr. Treneglas eased off the top button of his breeches, and they bent to peer over the map which Captain Henshaw was unrolling on the table. "Now," said Ross, "here we have the old workings of Wheal Leisure and the direction of the tin-bearing load." He went on to explain the situation, the angle of the shafts to be sunk, and the adits, which would be driven in from the face of Leisure Cliff to unwater the mine.
"What's this here?"
Mr. Treneglas put a stubby, snuff-stained finger on a corner of the map. "That's the limit of the workings of Trevorgie Mine, so far as it is known," said Ross. "All accurate maps have been lost. These workings were old when my great-grandfather came to Trenwith."
Said Mr. Treneglas. "They knew what they was about in those days, yes?"
he agreed, sotto voce.
"They knew what they was about." "What do you mean, sir?" inquired Mr. Renfrew. "What do I what? Well, damn, if the old men was working tin here and here, they was working the back of Leisure Lode before it was discovered on my land. That's what I mean." "I think he's right," said Henshaw, with a sudden quickening of interest. "In what way does that assist us?" asked Mr. Pierce, scratching himself.
"It only means," Ross said, "that the old men would not have driven all this way under such conditions for nothing. It was their custom to avoid all but the shallowest underground work. They had to. If they went this far, they must have found some good return as they went along."
"Think you it is all one great load, eh?" said Mr. Treneglas. "Could it run so far, Henshaw? Has any been known to run so far?"
"We don't know and shan't know, sir. Looks to me as if they was following tin and struck copper. That's how it seems to me. It is very feasible."
"I've a great respect for the ancients," said Mr. Treneglas, opening his snuff-box. "Look at Xenophanes. Look at Plotinus. Look at Democritus. They were wiser than we. It is no disgrace to follow where they led. What will it cost us, dear boy?"
Ross exchanged a glance with Henshaw. "I am willing at the outset to be manager and head purser without payment, and Captain Henshaw will supervise the beginnings at a nominal salary. Mr. Renfrew will supply us with most of the gear and tackle at the lowest margin of profit to himself, and I have arranged for Pascoe's bank to honour our drafts up to 300 guineas for the buying of winches and other heavy equipment. 50 guineas each would cover the expense of the first 3 months." There was a moment's silence, and Ross watched their faces with a slight cynical lift of his eyebrow. He had cut down the opening figure to the lowest possible, knowing that a big demand would result in another stalemate.
8 fives, said Mr. Treneglas. "And 3 from Pascoe's, that's 7 in all. 700 on an outlay of 50 each seems very reasonable to me, what? Expected 100 at least," he added to himself. "Quite expected 100. "That's only the first outlay," said Choke. "That's only the first 3 months." "All the same, it is very reasonable, gentlemen," said Mr. Renfrew. "These are expensive days. You could hardly expect to become interested in a gainful venture for less."
"Quite true," said Mr. Treneglas. "Well then, I'm for starting right away. Decide by a show of hands, what?"
"This loan from Pascoe's bank," said Dr. Choke heavily. "That means we should put all our business through them. But what's wrong with Warleggans? Might we not get better terms from them? George Warleggan is a personal friend of ours."
Mr. Pierce said,
"A matter I was about to raise myself, sir. Now, if George Warleggan is a friend of mine too," Ross said, "but I don't think friendship should come into a matter of business."
"Not if it be detrimental to the business, no," said the doctor. "But Warleggan's is the biggest bank in the county, and the most up-to-date. Pascoe's has old-fashioned ideas. Pascoe's has not advanced in 40 years. I knew Harris Pascoe when he was a boy. He's a stick in the mire, and always has been."
Mr. Pierce said,
"My clients, I believe,
quite understood it would be Warleggan's bank.
Ross filled his pipe. Mr. Treneglas unfastened another button of his breeches.
Nay, one bank's the same as another to me. So long as it's sound, eh? That's the point, eh? You had a reason for going to Pascoe's, Ross, I suppose, what?
There is no grudge between the Warleggans and me, father or son. But as a banking partnership, they own too many mines already. I do not wish them to come to own Wheal Leisure. Choke bent his heavy eyebrows.
I should not care to let the Warleggans hear you say that.
Nonsense. I say nothing that everyone does not know. Between them and their puppet companies, they own a dozen mines outright and have large interests in a dozen others, including Grambler and Wheal Plenty. If they chose to close Grambler tomorrow, they would do so, as they have closed Wheal Reef. There is nothing underhand in that. But if Wheal Leisure is opened, then I prefer to keep such decisions in the hands of the venturers. Big concerns are dangerous friends for the small man.
I quite agree, gentlemen, Mr. Renfrew concurred nervously. There was bad feeling at St. Anne's about the closing of Wheal Reef. We know it was not an economical mine to maintain. But that does not help the shareholders who have lost their money, nor the 200 miners who have lost their work. But it helps Wheal Plenty to offer only starvation wages, and it gives young Mr. Warleggan a chance of showing a tidy profit.
The issue had touched some sore point in Mr. Renfrew's memory. A wrangle broke out, with everybody talking at once. Mr. Treneglas banged on the table with his glass.
"Put it to the vote!" he shouted. "It is the only sensible way. But first, the mine. Let's have the faint hearts declare themselves afore we go any further."
The vote was taken, and all were for opening.
"Good! Splendid!" said Mr. Treneglas. "We're getting on at last. Now, this question of the bank, eh? Who's in favour of Pascoe's?"
Renfrew, Henshaw, Treneglas and Ross were for Pascoe's, Choke and Pierce for Warleggans. As Pierce carried with him the votes of his nominees, the voting was even.
"Damn," mumbled Mr. Treneglas. "I knew that lawyer fellow would balk us again."
Mr. Pierce could not miss hearing this, and tried hard to be offended. But secretly, he was looking for a share in Mr. Treneglas's estate business, and finding Mr. Treneglas firm on his course, he spent the next 10 minutes tacking round to the old man's point of view. Left alone, Choke gave in, and the absent Warleggans were defeated. Ross knew their adventure was so small as to be hardly worth the attention of a large banking firm, but that they had received it he was in no doubt. George would be annoyed. Now that the chief hurdles had been taken, the rest of the business went through quickly enough. Captain Henshaw stretched his big legs, got up and, with a nod from Ross, passed the decanter round the table.
"I don't doubt you'll pardon the liberty, gentlemen. We've sat round this table as equals, and we're equal partners in the venture. Nay, though I am the poorest, my share stands biggest in the general pool, for my reputation's there as well as my 50 guineas. So here's a toast. Wheal Leisure!"
The others rose and clinked their glasses.
"Wheal Leisure! Wheal Leisure! Wheal Leisure!"
They drained their glasses. In the kitchen, Judd, who had been whittling a piece of wood and humming his favourite tune, raised his head and spat expertly across the table into the fire.
"Something's moving at last. Dang me if it don't sound like they're going to open the blathering mine after all."
"Dirty old black worm," said Prudy. "You nearly spit in the stew pot that time."
Chapter 2. When his new partners had gone, Ross left the house and strolled across his land towards the site of his mine. He did not go down to the beach and across the sand hills, but made a semicircular detour which kept to the high ground. Wheal Leisure was on the first promontory, midway along Hendrawna Beach, where the sand hills gave place to rock. There was as yet little to see. Two shallow tunnels slanting down and a number of trenches, all made by the old men. A new tunnel with a ladder, and a few turfs cut to show where the new work was to be. Rabbits dodged and dipped their tails as he moved about. A curlew cried. A strong wind murmured through the coarse grass. Little to see, but by the end of the summer, the view would be changed. During the years of planning and frustration, this idea had grown on him until it took first interest in his mind. The venture would have been started 18 months ago if it had not been for Mr. Pierce, who felt a natural care for the safety of his nominee's money, and the hesitancies and pessimism of Choke, whom Ross was now sorry to have brought in. All the others were gamblers, ready and eager to take a chance. Despite all the fine arguments today, there was really no improvement in prospects over a year ago. But old Mr. Treneglis had happened to be in boisterous spirits, and had carried the others with him. So the gamblers had at last had their way. The future would decide the rest. He stared across to where the chimneys of Mellin cottages were just visible in the valley. He would be able to help Jim Carter now. Help him without suspicion of charity, which the boy would never accept. As assistant purser at the mine, he could be brought in to relieve Ross of some of the supervision. And later, when he had learned to read and write, there was no reason why he shouldn't be paid 40 or more shillings a month. It would help both Jim and Ginny to forget the tragedy of 2 years ago. Ross began to pace out again, the position where the first shaft would be sunk. The irony of that tragedy at Mellin Cottages was that physically, actually, it could have been so much worse. In the end, only one life had been lost, that of Reuben Clemo himself. The baby Benjamin Ross had suffered a cut on the head and cheek, which would never be more than a minor disfigurement, and Ginny had escaped with a stab which closely missed her heart. She had been in bed for weeks, with internal bleeding, which her mother, eventually forgetting her Methody scruples, swore she cured with a lock of her grandmother's hair. But that was long ago, and Ginny was well, and had had a baby girl, Mary, since then. It could have been so much worse. But just as baby Benjamin would always show the marks of the attack on his face, so it seemed Ginny was to carry them on her spirit. She had become listless, silent, unpredictable of mood. Even Jim was often not sure what she was thinking. When Jim was at the mine, her mother would trot over and stay for an hour, amiably prattling about the happenings of the day. Then she would kiss her daughter and trot the few steps back to her own kitchen, with an uneasy feeling that Ginny had not been listening at all. Jim, too, had lost his buoyancy because of the sense of guilt that he could not be rid of. He would never forget the moment when he came back to find Reuben Clemo dying on his doorstep, and the entry into his own bedroom with his child crying in the darkness, and a weight that had to be pushed off the trapdoor. He could not escape from the fact that had he not gone out, the tragedy would not have happened. He gave up his association with Nick Vigus, and no more pheasants made their appearance in his kitchen. In fact, these were no longer needed, for the whole neighbourhood took their case to heart. A public subscription was raised, and all manner of presents were sent to them, so that while Ginny was laid up, and for some time afterwards, they enjoyed a bounty they had never known before. But it was a bounty Jim privately disliked, and he was relieved when it tapered off. His pitch at Grambler was yielding good results, and they had no need of charity. What they had need of was something which would wipe out the memory of that night. Ross finished his pacing and stared down at the sandy earth. The eternal enigma of the prospector faced him. Whether this acre of ground held under its surface riches or frustration. Time and work and patience. He grunted and looked up at the sky, which promised rain. Well, If the worst came to the worst, they would be giving a few miners the chance of feeding their families. Conditions, everyone agreed, could hardly be worse throughout the county, or indeed throughout the country as a whole. Conditions could hardly be worse, they thought, with the 3% at 56. The whole nation felt down in the mouth after the unequal struggle against France and Holland and Spain, the perverse unbrotherly war with America, and the threat of further enemies in the north. It was a spiritual as well as a material slough. 25 years ago, she had been leader of the world, and the fall had been all the greater. Peace had come at last, but the country was too weary to throw off the effects of war. A tenacious prime minister, at 27, was holding his uneasy position in the face of all the coalitions to upset him. But the coalitions had hopes. Money had to be found. Even for peace and reform, taxes had gone up 20% in 5 years, and the new ones were dangerously unpopular. Land tax, house tax, servants tax, window tax, horses and hats, bricks and tiles, linen and calicoes. Another impost on candles hit directly at the poor. Last winter, the fishermen of Foy had saved their families from starvation by feeding them on limpets. It would take 50 years, some people said, before things righted themselves. Even in America, Ross had been told, disillusion was no less. The United States had so far been united only in a dislike for overlordship. And with that gone, and all the after-war problems in train, they seemed on the point of breaking up into local self-governing republics, quarrelling endlessly among themselves, like the cities of medieval Italy. Frederick of Prussia, tapping away with gouty fingers on his piano in the Sanssouci Palace at Potsdam, had been heard to say that the country was so unwieldy that now they had got rid of George III, the only solution was to set up a king of their own. The remark even found its way into the fastness of Cornish society. Other things too the Cornish knew, or sensed, with their constant illicit traffic between the French ports and their own. England might be down in the mouth, but things were even worse in Europe. Strange whiffs of a volcanic unrest came to them from time to time from across the channel. Dislike for an old enemy as much as idealism for a new friend had tempted France to pour out her gold and men to help American freedom. Now she found herself with an extra war debt of 1,400 million livres and a knowledge of the theory and practice of revolution bred in the minds and blood of her thinkers and soldiers. The crust of the European despotisms was being weakened at its weakest spot. In 2 years, Ross had seen little of his own family and class. What he had overheard in the library on the day of Geoffrey Charles's christening had filled him with contempt for them, and though he would not have admitted to being influenced one way or the other by Polly Choke's gossip, an awareness of their clacking tongues made him dislike the idea of going among them. Monthly, out of common courtesy, he went to inquire after the invalid Charles, who refused either to die or get better. But when he found company there, his conversation didn't touch on the popular subjects. He was not as concerned as they about the return of Maria Fitzherbert from the continent, or the scandal of the Queen of France's necklace. There were families in the district without enough bread and potatoes to keep them alive, and he wanted these families to be given gifts in kind, so that the epidemics of December and January should not have such easy prey. His listeners felt uncomfortable when he was speaking, and resentful when he had finished. Many of them were hard hit themselves by the slump in mining and the increased taxation. Many were helping those hard cases with which they came in contact, and if that barely touched the fringe of the distress, they did not see that Ross was doing any more. What they were not prepared to accept was that they had any sort of liability for the hardships of the day, or that laws could be framed to offer some less soul-destroying form of relief than the poorhouse and the parish cart. Even Francis could not see it. Ross felt like another Jack Tripp, preaching reform from an empty tub. He topped the crest of the hill on the way home and saw de Melzer coming to meet him. Garrick was trotting at her heels like a small Shetland pony. She hopped from time to time as she came up.
"Judd to tell me," she said, "that the mine is to open at last."
"Just as soon as we can hire the men and buy the tackle."
"Hooray! Garrick, go down." "I'm real pleased about that. We was all disappointed last year, when we thought 'twas all set, sir. Garrick, be quiet. Will it be as big as Grambler?"
"Not yet." He was amused at her excitement. "Quite a little mine to begin."
"I'm sure 'twill soon be a big un with great chimney stacks and things."
They walked down the hill together. Normally, he took her very much for granted, but the interest of the others today made him steal a sidelong glance at her now. A well-grown and developing girl, barely recognizable as the scrawny half-starved urchin he had swilled under the pump. More changes had come about during the last year. De Melzer was now a sort of general housekeeper. Prudy was far too indolent to wish to manage anything if there was a way out of it. Her leg had given her trouble two or three times more, and when she came downstairs again, it was easier to potter about in the kitchen, brewing tea for herself and doing a little light work, than contriving the meals and cooking them, which de Melzer so much seemed to enjoy. The burden was off her shoulders. De Melzer never dictated, and was quite willing to continue doing her own work as well. So what was there to object to in that? Apart from one violent quarrel, life in the kitchen was more peaceful than when Judd and Prudy shared it alone. A rough camaraderie had grown up between the three, and the painters did not seem to resent Ross's friendship with the girl. There were plenty of times when he was lonely and glad of companionship. Verity no longer had the heart to come over, and de Melzer took her place. Sometimes she even sat with him in the evening. It had begun with her going to ask him for orders about the farm, by her staying to talk. And then, somehow, she was sitting in the parlour with him two or three evenings a week. She was, of course, the most amenable of companions, being content to talk if he wanted to talk, or to persevere with her reading if he wanted to read, or willing to slip out at once if her presence was unwelcome. He still drank heavily. She was not quite a perfect housekeeper, though she came near enough to it for normal needs. There were times when her temperament played a part. The moods of which Prudy had spoken still took her. Then she could outswear Judd, and once had nearly outfought him. Her sense of personal danger was at all times non-existent. But at such times even her industry was misdirected. One dark, rainy morning of last October, she had chosen to clean out part of the cattle shed and began pushing the oxen around when they got in the way. Presently one resented this, and she came out boiling with indignation and wounded in a manner that made sitting down impossible for a week. Another time, she chose to move all the kitchen furniture while Judd and Prudy were out, but one cupboard was too much even for her energy, and she pulled it over on herself. Prudy came back to find her pinned underneath, while Garrick barked his appreciation at the door. The affair of the quarrel with Judd had a more serious side, and was now discreetly forgotten by all. De Melzer had tasted the bottle of spirits in the old iron box in the library, and, liking the taste, had finished the bottle. Then she went prancing in to Judd, who by mischance had also been having a private sup. She so tormented him that he fell upon her with some indistinct notion of slaying her. But she fought back like a wild cat, and when Prudy came in, she found them struggling on the floor. Prudy had jumped instantly to the wrong conclusion and had attacked Judd with the hearth shovel. Ross's arrival was only just in time to prevent most of his staff being laid up with serious injuries. A frozen equanimity had fallen on the kitchen for weeks after that. For the first time, Demelza had felt the acid sting of Ross's tongue and had curled up and wanted to die. But that was 12 months ago. It was a grisly spectre buried in the past. Without further speech, they passed through the apple trees and walked towards the house, through the garden on which Demelza had put in so many extra hours last summer. All the weeds had been cleared, leaving much bare earth and a few straggling remnants of the plants Ross's mother had grown. There were 3 lavender bushes, tall and ungainly from the press of weeds. There was a bush of rosemary, freed from its tangle and promising flower. She had also unearthed a damask rose, with its bright splashed flowers of pink and white, and a moss rose and 2 monthly roses. And in her quest about the countryside, she had begun to bring home seeds and roots from the hedgerows. These were no easy things to rear. They had all the waywardness of wild things, ready to luxuriate in desolate places of their own choosing, but apt to pine and die when confined within the luxury of a garden. But last year she had had fine spurs of viper's bugloss, a patch of sea pinks, and a row of crimson foxgloves. They stopped now, Demelza explaining what she proposed to do here and there, suggesting that she might take cuttings from the lavender bush and try to root them to make a hedge. Ross looked about him with a tolerant eye. He was not greatly interested in flowers, but he admired the neatness and the colour, and herbs, which could be cooked or infused, were useful. Recently, he had given her a little money for her own use, and with this, she had bought a bright kerchief to wrap around her head, a pen to learn to write, 2 copybooks, a pair of shoes with paste buckles, a big chrome mug to hold flowers, a sunbonnet for Prudy, and a snuff box for Judd. Twice he had let her mount Ramoth and ride with him into Truro. Once, when he had promised to visit the cockpit and watch Royal Duke fight for a 50-guinea purse. This entertainment, to his surprise and amusement, quite disgusted her.
"Why," she said, "'tis no better than father to do."
She had expected something more refined of a cockfight patronized by the nobility and gentry. On the way home, she had been unusually silent.
"Don't you think animals do feel hurt like we?"
she got out eventually. Ross considered his answer. He had been led once or twice before into pitfalls by making unthinking replies to her questions. "I don't know," he said briefly.
"Then why do veers squeal like they do when you put rings through their noses?"
"Cockerels aren't pigs. God made it their nature to fight." She did not speak for a time.
"Yes, but God didn't give them steel spurs to fight with."
"You should have been a lawyer, Demelza," he commented, and at that she had been silent again. He thought of these things while they talked in the garden. He wondered if she knew what Nat Pierce and the others had been thinking when they stared at her in the parlour a couple of hours ago, and whether she agreed with him that no idea could be more ridiculous. When he wanted that sort of pleasure, he would call for Margaret in Truro, or one of her kind. It seemed to him sometimes that if pleasure lay in the unsubtle sport that a harlot afforded, then he had not quite the normal appetites of a normal man. Well, there was an odd satisfaction in asceticism, a cumulative self-knowledge and self-reliance. He thought very little about it these days. He had other interests and other concerns. Chapter 3. Before she left him, Demelza said she had seen Ginny Carter early that day, and Jim was sick with a pleurisy. But Jim, with his uncertain health, was often laid up for a few days, and Ross did not take account of it. All the next fortnight, he was busy with matters concerning the opening of the mine, and he put off seeing Jim until he could offer him certain cut and dried duties. He did not want this to seem a made-up job. The library at Nampara was to serve as a mining office, and the domestic life of the house was disrupted while part of this was cleared and repaired. News that a mine was to open instead of close spread quickly, and they were besieged with miners from up to 18 miles distant, anxious to take the work at any price. Ross and Henshaw tried to strike bargains fair to both sides. They engaged 40 men, including a grass captain and an underground captain, who would be responsible to Henshaw. At the end of the fortnight, Ross met Zaki Martin and inquired about Jim. Jim was up, Zaki said, though not yet back at the mine, being troubled with his cough. Ross thought over the arrangements, so far as they had gone. Next Monday, 8 men would begin the adit from the face of the cliff, and another 20 would be put to work on the first shaft. It was time for the assistant purser to be brought in. "Tell him to come round and see me tomorrow morning, will you?" Ross said.
"Yes," said Zaki. "I'll see Ginny tonight. I'll tell her to tell him. She won't forget."
Jim Carter was not asleep and heard the faint tapping on the door almost as soon as it began. Very cautiously, so as not to wake Ginny or the babies, he slid out of bed and began to gather up his clothes. Once he trod on a loose floorboard, and he stood still for some seconds suppressing a cough, until the girl's regular breathing reassured him. Then he pulled on his breeches and shirt and picked up his boots and coat. The hinge of the trap door usually groaned when it was moved, but he had put grease on it earlier in the day, and it opened now with no noise. He was halfway through when a voice said,
"Jim?"
He bit his lip in annoyance, but did not reply. She might yet only be speaking in her sleep. There was silence. Then she went on.
"Jim, you're going out with Nick Vigus again. Why didn't you tell me? I knew you'd only make a fuss." "Well, you needn't go." "Yes, I do. I promised Nick yesterday." "Tell him you've changed your mind." "I haven't." "Captain Poldark wants you in the morning, Jim. Have you forgotten that?"
"I shall be back long afore morning."
"Maybe he'll want you to take a pitch at the new mine."
Jim said,
"I couldn't take it, Ginny. 'Tis a speculation, no more and no less. I couldn't give up a good pitch for that." "A good pitch is no good if you've to wade to your chin in water going forth and back to it. No matter of wonder you cough." "Well, when I go out to get a bit of extry, all you do is complain." "We can manage, Jim. Easy. I don't want more. Not that way. It fair sticks in my throat when I think how you've come by it."
"I aren't all that methody."
"No more am I. 'Tis knowing the danger you've been in to get it." "There's no danger, Ginny," he said in a softer tone. "Nought to fret about. Honest, I'll be all right."
A faint tapping was heard on the door again. He said,
"'Tis only while I'm not earning. You know that. I shan't be up of nights when I'm back on my pitch. Goodbye now." "Jim," she said urgently, "I wished you wouldn't go tonight. Not tonight." "Hush. You'll wake the babies. Think on them and the other one coming. We've got to keep you well fed, Ginny dear." "I'd rather starve."
The three words floated down into the dark kitchen as he descended, but he heard no more. He unbolted the door, and Nick Vigus slipped inside like a piece of rubber.
"You've been some long time. Got the nets?"
"All ready now."
"Brr, it's cold."
Jim put on his coat and boots and they went out, Nick whispering to his dog. Their walk was to be a fairly long one, about 5 miles each way, and for some time they tramped in silence. It was a perfect night, starlit and clear but cold, with a northwesterly breeze thrusting in from the sea. Jim shivered and coughed as he walked. Their way lay southeast, skirting the hamlet of Marazanvoz, climbing to the main coaching road, and then dropping into the fertile valley beyond. They were entering Bodruggan land, profitable country but dangerous, and they began to move with the utmost caution. Nick Vigus led the way, and the thin lurcher made a second shadow at his heels. Jim was a few paces behind, carrying a stick about 10 feet long and a homemade net. They avoided a carriage drive and entered a small wood. In the shadow, Nick stopped.
"They blasted stars are as sharp as a quarter moon. I misdoubt if we'll have as fair a bag."
"Well, we can't go back without a try. It appears to me..."
"Shh! Quiet!"
They crouched in the undergrowth and listened. Then they went on. The wood thinned out, and 100 yards ahead, the trees broke into a big clearing 1/2 mile square. Fringing one side was a stream, and about the stream a thicket of bushes and young trees. It was here that the pheasants roosted. Those in the lower branches were easy game for a quick man with a net. The danger was that at the other end of the clearing stood Wary House, the home of the Bodruggans. Nick stopped again.
"What did he hear?" Jim asked.
"Something,"
whispered Vigus. The starlight glistened on his bald pink head and made little shadows of the pits in his face. He had the look of a perverted cherub.
"They keepers, on the prowl tonight."
They waited for some minutes in silence. Jim suppressed a cough and put his hand on the dog's head. It moved a moment and was still.
"Lurch's all right," said Nick. "Reckon 'twas a false alarm."
They began to move again through the undergrowth. As they neared the edges of the clearing, it became a question not so much of disturbing the keepers, who perhaps had not been there at all, but of not flushing the pheasants until it was too late for them to fly. The brightness of the night would make this difficult. They whispered together and chose to separate, each man taking one net and closing in on the covey from an opposite direction. Vigus, who was the more practiced, was to make the longer detour. Jim had a gift for stealthy movement, and he went on very slowly until he could see the dark shapes of the birds, pod-like among the branches and in the low forks of the tree just ahead. He unwound the net from his arm, but decided to give Nick another 2 minutes, lest he should spring the trap half-set. As he stood there, he could hear the wind soughing in the branches above him. In the distance, Wary House was a dark, alien bulk among the softer contours of the night. One light still burned. The time was after 1, and he wondered about the people who lived there, and why they were keeping such late hours. He wondered what Captain Poldark would have to say to him. He owed a lot there, but that made him feel he couldn't accept any more favours. That was, always supposing he could keep his health. It would be no benefit to Ginny to do as his father had done and die at 26. Ginny made a to-do about him having to wade through water to his working pitch every day, but she didn't realise that they were all wet and dry most of the time. If a man couldn't put up with that, he wasn't fitted to be a miner. At present he was free of the blasting powder, and that was something to be thankful for. An animal stirred in the thicket near him. He turned his head and tried to see but could not. The tree beyond was gnarled and misshapen. A young oak, one would guess, from the dead leaves on its branches. They hung there rustling in the breeze all the winter through. A peculiar swollen shape. And then the shape changed slightly. Jim screwed up his eyes and stared. A man was standing against the tree. So their visit of Saturday had not gone unmarked. Perhaps every night since then, there had been gamekeepers waiting patiently for their next visit. Perhaps he had already been seen. No. But if he moved forward, he was as good as caught. What of Nick coming round from the north? Jim's mind was frozen by the need to make an instant choice. He began to move slowly away. He had not taken two steps when there was the sound of a broken twig behind him. He twisted in time to avoid a grasp on his shoulder and plunged towards the pheasants, dropping his net as he ran. In the same second, there was a scuffle at the other side and the discharge of a musket. Suddenly, the wood came to life, with the cry of cock pheasants and the beating of their startled wings as they rose, with the stirring of other game disturbed, with men's voices shouting directions for his capture. He came to open ground and ran flatly, skirting the edge of the stream and keeping as much as possible in the deep shadow. He could hear running footsteps behind and knew that he was not outdistancing them. His heart pounded and his breath grew tight. At a break in the trees, he swerved and ran amongst them. He was not now far from the house, and he could see that this was a formal path he followed. In here, it was darker, and the undergrowth between the trees was so dense that it would be hard to force a way through it without giving them time to catch up. He came upon a small clearing. In the middle was a circular marble pavilion and a sundial. The path did not go beyond this point. He ran towards the pavilion, then changed his mind and made for the edge of the clearing, where a big elm tree leaned out and away. He scrambled up the trunk, scratching his hands and breaking his nails on the bark. He had just reached the second branch when two gamekeepers pounded into the clearing. He lay still, drawing thinly at the air. The two men hesitated and peered about the clearing, one with head bent forward, listening.
"Not gone fur. Hiding out,"
floated across to the tree. They walked furtively into the clearing. One went up the steps and tried the door of the pavilion. It was locked. The other stepped back and stared up at the circular domed roof. Then they divided and made a slow circuit of the open space. As one of them approached his tree, Jim suddenly felt that peculiar stirring in his lung, which he knew meant an attack of coughing. The sweat came out afresh on his forehead. The gamekeeper slowly went past. Jim saw that he carried a gun. Just beyond the leaning elm, the man stopped at a tree which looked more scalable than the rest, and began to peer up through its branches. Jim gasped at the air, and choked, and got a breath and held it. The second man made his tour, and was coming to rejoin his companion.
"See naught of him?"
"No, bastard must have escaped."
"Did they catch the other un?"
"No, thought we'd got this un, though. Ace."
Jim's lungs were expanding and contracting of their own accord. The itch welled up irresistibly in his throat, and he choked.
"What's that?" said one of the men.
"Dunno, over here."
They came sharply towards the elm, but mistook the direction by 20 feet, frowning into the tangled undergrowth.
"Stay there,"
said one.
"I'll see what I can find."
He forced his way through the bushes and disappeared. The other stood against the bole of a tree with his gun at the cock. Jim grasped at the branch above him in a frantic effort to hold his cough. He was soaked now with sweat, and even capture seemed little more fearful than this convulsive strain. His head was bursting. He would give the rest of his life to be able to cough. There was a trampling and a cracking, and the second gamekeeper came out, cursing his disappointment.
"He's gone, I reckon. Let's see what Johnson's done."
"How about getting the dogs?"
"They've naught to go on. Maybe we'll catch 'em proper next week."
The two men moved off, but they had not gone 10 paces when they were stopped by a violent explosion of coughing just